This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
From the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX, this is Reveal. I'm Al Letson. In July of 2018, producer Kate McMahon was vacationing with her family in Victoria, British Columbia. One morning, Kate made a discovery that would send her into a year-long reporting journey. So Kate, tell us what happened that morning.
Well, I was going for a run, and I spotted a herd of deer in some woods across the road. So I decided to follow them to take video with my smartphone for my kids.
See, it's a mama, a daddy, and a baby fawn.
I realize I'm standing in this cemetery. One gravestone I'm standing over totally gives me chills.
Tanya Van Kylenberg, 1969 to 1987. She parts her wings and then she's gone.
She was only 18 years old, I'm wondering. Car accident, drug overdose. And so I take a picture of her grave.
Why'd you take a picture?
It was just a moment of feeling like I wanted to put good thoughts out there for this girl's family, whoever they were. And then something mind-blowing happens later that night. I show my husband the photo, and he says, "I know that name." I don't believe him. We are in a foreign country, and I had followed deer into a random cemetery. So I go online and find out he's actually right. Tanya's name had been in the news that week. And I find out how she died. She and her boyfriend had been murdered 31 years before, and no one had been arrested until now.
We first aired this episode in October and are bringing it back today because there have been some developments. We pick up with Kate, piecing together the last day anyone saw the young couple alive.
It's November 18th, 1987, and this young Canadian couple, Tanya Van Kylenberg and Jay Cook, are taking their first big trip together, alone. It's a short trip, just one night away from home. They're on an errand for Jay's dad, who needs them to buy a furnace part in Seattle. I recently retraced their steps. They board the ferry in Victoria Harbor in Jay's van and head to Port Angeles. But Tanya and Jay never make it to Seattle.
They left on a Wednesday, and they were to return basically by midday on Thursday was the expectation. And when they didn't return on Thursday, my parents were of the firm view that there was something wrong.
That's Tanya's big brother, John Van Kylenberg. Meeting him for the first time, it strikes me that if Tanya had lived, she might have grown into certain traits like John. Courteous, gentle, dutiful. I notice a weariness in his eyes, though, and he fidgets with a water bottle as we talk. John tells me that 6 days after the couple went missing, the police called his family's home. They had found the body of a girl in a rural area just north of Seattle.
And then my father and I had to identify her, and which unfortunately it was, so Tanya. So that was the dark, very dark day.
What I'm about to describe is pretty gruesome. The killer had shot Tanya in the back of the head, execution style. A stranger's semen is found on her pants and in her body. Jay's van is found the next day and his body the day after that, about 70 miles away from Tanya in another rural area. Jay's head had been beaten. He'd been strangled. A pack of cigarettes stuffed into his mouth.
There were just so many questions, no answers. The police couldn't give us any answers. They didn't know what the heck had happened. And, so you just had to, you just kind of gave up.
The funeral takes place at the University of Victoria Chapel. There's standing room only.
It was, huge attendance. I mean, as often happens when young people die.
I asked John about the epitaph on Tanya's grave that says, "She parts her wings and then she's gone."
It was a line she'd written in some of her own poetry. And, it obviously struck my dad as being, oddly eerie in one sense of her having left us too soon like that.
The case remains unsolved for the next few years. In 1990, it's featured in an episode of America's Unsolved Mysteries.
Next, the story of an innocent young couple whose romantic weekend was shattered by a sadistic and elusive killer.
The show interviews a Seattle police detective at the time who says surgical gloves were left behind by the killer.
He leaves those behind as basically a sign to the police that you needn't look for fingerprints because I wore these gloves. And he has confidence that there's nothing that's going to connect him with these crimes.
The story generates no viable leads. Years peel by. The families still have no answers from police. Then, new hope. DNA is taking the place of the fingerprint as law enforcement's most cutting-edge tool. In 1994, the FBI creates a DNA database called CODIS. It contains genetic profiles of people who've been arrested or convicted of crimes. Police can compare DNA they recover from crime scenes with this database to identify suspects. In Tanya and Jay's case, police check CODIS periodically, but never find a match. The case goes cold until 2005. Detective Jim Scharf of the Snohomish County Sheriff's Office comes on the scene.
This is where we book all of the evidence in.
I meet Detective Scharf at the evidence room in Everett, Washington.
Package it here, log it into this computer.
He likes to go by Jim. He shows me the process of booking evidence using a roll of tape as an example.
So we're going to book this into evidence, so we're going to take it and we'd put it in a sack.
Jim seals up the sack, writes his initials on it, and sticks it in a locker. I'm struck by how, I don't know, analog it all seems.
And then shut it.
Jim has a neatly trimmed gray mustache, and his eyes are soft in the corners. When I ask him about restaurants in Everett, he tells me he usually just goes to Arby's. I glimpse a pistol under his jacket when he sits down.
I was a major crimes detective, and we were just getting ready to start the cold case team.
Jim reopened Tanya and Jay's cold case, and for more than a decade, he followed all kinds of leads. But like the detective before him, never found a DNA match in CODIS. Then, in 2017, he hears about a new way to use DNA to identify people.
Investigators say they were able to create these sketches of a possible suspect using DNA phenotyping.
Phenotyping is this revolutionary new forensics technology. It takes DNA from an unknown person and creates a computer drawing of what they look like.
It provided information of the person's, like, hair color, eye color, complexion.
The DNA found on Tanya generates three faces of a white man. First, as he appears at age 25 with reddish-brown hair. Then, 45 and 65. He has deep facial lines and is going gray. To Detective Scharf, it's like staring the killer in the eye for the very first time. The phenotype helps. Scharf is able to vastly shrink the haystack of suspects by ruling out people who don't look like the sketch. But still, no DNA match. Then, in April 2018, news from California changes everything in the world of DNA and crime solving.
Tonight, a four-decade-old search for one of history's most infamous serial killers may be over.
We found the needle in the haystack.
Police announcing the capture of 72-year-old Joseph James DeAngelo, a man they say is the elusive Golden State Killer.
I'm like, who's the Golden State Killer? I've never even heard of this guy.
Scharf goes online and learns he's a serial killer and rapist who victimized more than 60 people in the 70s and 80s in Northern California. The alleged Golden State Killer was found with a mind-blowing new forensics technique called genetic genealogy.
Genetic genealogy is using DNA to learn more about someone's family history and family tree.
That's CC Moore, She's one of the top genetic genealogists in the world. She even appears as the DNA expert on the hit PBS television series Finding Your Roots with Henry Louis Gates Jr.
She's a detective with skills that would put Sherlock Holmes to shame.
In addition to helping people trace their ancestors, Cece uses genetic genealogy to find the living, usually adoptees searching for their birth parents.
For any type of human identification, there really isn't anything more powerful than DNA and genetic genealogy.
There are two main reasons genetic genealogy is so powerful. First, because it reaches far beyond the FBI's CODIS database of convicts and people who've been arrested. And second, it incorporates much more genetic data. It's really complicated, but here's the gist of it. Law enforcement uses CODIS to analyze 20 genetic markers. Genetic genealogy analyzes about 800,000. It can identify very distant relatives and ancestors from generations ago. It casts a really wide net, but only works if it can access a lot of DNA profiles. By 2018, more than 25 million consumers had added their DNA to the leading ancestry databases. But those companies, like 23andMe and Ancestry.com, keep each other locked out of their customers' data. Police are locked out too, unless they get a court order. So what was the key in the Golden State Killer case? Well, there's this website called GEDmatch. It allows people who get their DNA tested by one company to compare their genetic profile with customers who used other companies. It's sort of like a DNA swap meet. And it's open access to the public.
If you tested at 23andMe, I was at Ancestry DNA, and we wanted to see if we shared DNA, we could both upload to GEDmatch without having to pay for another test.
In the beginning, only serious genealogists used GEDmatch. But in the case of the Golden State Killer, the cops got in and were able to access about a million users' genetic profiles.
Investigators found D'Angelo using DNA from crime scenes decades ago, which they submitted to a publicly shared genealogy website called GEDmatch.
It worked so well that GEDmatch decided to make clear that law enforcement can search it.
And they put a big notification on the homepage of GEDmatch that said, law enforcement used the database, we're allowing that use.
That's when Cece and a company called Parabon Nanolabs saw an opportunity and decided to team up. Parabon made the computer drawings of the suspect's face for Detective Scharf. He remembers getting a call from the CEO soon after the Golden State Killer arrest.
And he said, well, if you give me written permission, I'll upload our DNA profile to GEDmatch for you for free.
In other words, Parabon was offering to plug the DNA file from Tanya's crime scene into GEDmatch to try and find a relative of the killer.
So it was uploaded on, I think, a Friday, and I waited, no matches. Saturday morning, I woke up and there were matches, and I got to work on it.
The GEDmatch algorithm points her to people who share DNA with the unknown suspect. Then the family tree building comes in. I wanted to understand what it looks like, so I asked Cece to show me. We're in her living room with a view of the Pacific Ocean. She settles into her workplace, the sofa, and opens up her laptop. I see graphics pop up of a family tree with people represented in pink and blue blocks.
And all 800,000 genetic markers were compared to everyone else's genetic markers in the database. Then we get a list of people that share significant amounts of DNA with that unknown suspect.
She tells me the top two matches share about 3% of their DNA with the unknown suspect.
Which would mean that they're second cousins or similar. So that means that my first theory is they share great grandparents with the suspect. So I have to figure out who these matches are because sometimes it's not obvious.
But in Tanya and Jay's case, Cece's very first one that could lead to an arrest, the answer comes quickly. In just 2 hours, she finds the suspect that had eluded police for more than 3 decades. She shows me the path she took through the family tree. From those second cousins, she finds a family with 4 children. One is a son.
Yeah, the DNA is pointing to this one person, and this is the only other option. And so by Monday, we communicated that to Detective Scharf.
Jim is out walking his little black pug dogs when he gets a message from the CEO of Parabon to call him. He's got good news.
And I'm like, well, what's the good news? And he says, well, Jim, I've got a name for you. I don't think I can believe this. You got a name for me. And he goes, yep, we've narrowed it down to one individual. They found his mother's obituary, and the obituary said that she had, you know, three daughters and only one son. So it has to be that son. And I said, can you give me the name? And he said, it's William Earl Talbot II.
Jim runs Talbot's name through public records, finds out where he lives and works. But before he can make an arrest, Scharf has to prove Talbot is the exact match to the crime scene DNA. He needs to get a saliva sample from him.
If you can get a cigarette butt or a coffee cup or a soda bottle or something that's been in the person's mouth that has their saliva on it, that's a much better source of DNA to know that it's a reliable source.
What happens next might sound like a cop show on TV. For several days, Jim's team of detectives follow Talbot, scout his workplace, a trucking company, lurk outside his house. Then, while tailing him through Seattle, they get a breakthrough.
And he drove up to the stoplight at Spokane Street and stopped. And for some reason, he opened the door of the semi-truck. And when he did that, somebody spotted a white paper cup on the street underneath the door. And they're like, hey, I think that fell out of his truck.
One of the cops dashes out in the middle of traffic and grabs the cup in the street. Now Scharf has something he can work with. He takes the cup to the State Patrol crime lab and returns the next day to hear the results from the DNA supervisor.
She says, Jim, she says, you have a match. So I fight back the tears and I just screamed, we got him.
The plan for the arrest is set. It goes down in the yard of the trucking company after Talbot gets off work. Detective Scharf is waiting outside in plain clothes. There are undercover agents hiding in black ski masks and SWAT gear as backup. At about 6 p.m., Talbot walks out.
And I said, are you William Talbot? He said, yes. I said, I'm Jim Scharf. I'm a detective with the sheriff's office. I reach out. He reaches out. I shake hands with him.
Jim explains he's investigating a homicide case and needs to rule out suspects. He tells Talbot he's one of many people on the list.
He says, why don't you come back tomorrow or the next day? And I said, well, you know, we've come a long way. I says, can you give me your driver's license so I can check and see your ID to verify it's you? And he says, I told you who I am. So I could see that he was not going to cooperate. I said, okay, you're under arrest. Turn around and put your hands behind your back. And he says, what for? I said, for first-degree murder.
Jim arrests Talbot. He'd finally cracked the unsolved murder of Tanya Van Kuylenberg and Jay Cook that had haunted their families for decades. He calls Tanya's brother, John.
So, yeah, I remember he told me that, yeah, we've arrested him, John. And I said, really? And he said, yeah. I said, well, where is he? He says, in the back seat. And I'm like, whoa. So all of a sudden, after 31 years, like, here's Jim, this great guy. And he's telling me he's in the same vehicle as this guy at this point. And I remember a chill went down my spine. I was just like, it was just a real moment of realization, like, holy cow, like, there's actually, this is really, really concrete. And yeah, it was fantastic.
So after three decades, police arrest a suspect in a murder case that had seemed unsolvable. For Tanya and Jay's family members and for police, genetic genealogy seems like the greatest invention ever for solving crime. But some people worry that this powerful tool could be turned into a weapon.
Wouldn't it be terrible if our DNA information was used to persecute and prosecute people that didn't agree with them politically?
You're listening to Reveal.
At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science, neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories. Stories about policing or
politics,
country music,
hockey,
sex. Of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.
From the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX, this is Reveal. I'm Al Letson. We're re-airing the story of a killer today. On May 18th, 2018, one day after Detective Jim Scharf cornered William Talbot at work, his boss, the sheriff, calls a news conference to announce the arrest.
Good morning, and thank you all for being here. Yesterday, we took into custody a 55-year-old SeaTac man who is suspected of the 1987 murders of Jay Cook and Tanya Van Kylenberg.
Detective Scharf then steps to the podium to explain how they used genetic genealogy to identify Talbot as a suspect.
If it hadn't been for genetic genealogy, we wouldn't be standing here today, and if it's not allowed to be used in law enforcement, we would have never solved this case.
Right after Talbot's arrest, police around the country start using genetic genealogy and making arrests.
For three decades, the death of 8-year-old April Tinsley has baffled Indiana investigators. But this morning, police believe they finally solved the murder mystery.
From the day police picked up Talbot to a year later, genetic genealogy cracked more than 50 cases of murder and rape. That's a rate of more than one a week.
Police say they did it using genetic genealogy. The company ran the then-unknown DNA profile through a public database, and there was a partial match.
I hope it sends a message that obviously we're not going to quit on these cases.
And my hope is that it brings hope to other families that haven't had a resolve yet.
Most are cold cases, years old, but some just a few months. Genetic genealogist C.C. Moore, who helped finger William Talbot, is convinced her work with police is not just solving crimes, it's preventing them.
I've worked cases that were 3 months old, you know, that have a really high chance of reoffending and even escalating. And I'm sure there are, you know, people that were potentially serial killers that have been or will be stopped because of this.
But even as police crack cases faster than they ever thought possible, some people warn genetic genealogy is moving too fast, giving law enforcement too much access to personal information, and it needs to be reined in now. Reveal's Emily Harris has been working with reporter Kate McMahon on today's show, and Emily picks up this part of the story.
One person who believes genetic genealogy needs to be reined in is this man.
My name is Michael Usry. I live here in New Orleans, and I work in the film industry down here.
It's Sunday morning. I reach Michael on the phone as he's sitting in a small office in his house. He tells me about an encounter he had with a precursor of genetic genealogy back in 2014. He was visiting his parents a few hours out of town.
And I got a call from the police down here in New Orleans who told me my vehicle matched the description of a hit and run.
He knew he wasn't involved. He told the police he'd be happy to chat. He could meet them at his house around 2 that afternoon.
I pulled up at exactly 2 o'clock, and at 2:01, three officers were at my door. And I have a big 90-pound Labradoodle, and he likes to bark at people at the door. So he was all excited when they came in, and within about 30 seconds to a minute, they were asking me if I would mind going down to the station to talk to them.
Michael still has his Labradoodle. Bobo.
You want to go outside? Come on.
And as he left Bobo that day 6 years ago, getting into the back seat of the police car, Michael asked one of the officers if they really wanted to talk about a hit and run.
And at that point, he said, well, actually, we'd like to talk to you about some other things, too.
Just one other thing, it turned out. A murder. A young woman named Angie Dodge had been raped and stabbed multiple times in 1996. In Idaho. Michael had visited Idaho in the mid-1990s. His sisters had gone to college there. And he'd co-produced a short film about people who get obsessed with killers. It's called Murderabilia.
Tell me what you remember. Start when you entered the trailer and follow through until you left.
It's made up. It's a fictional film, but parts of it are pretty gruesome. And one killing described in it resembles what happened to Angie.
And I was shoving her and blocking her from the door and stabbing at her. Little nibs like, tack, tack, tack.
This is one of the things that the police saw online when they were researching me. They said, look at this. He makes short films about men sneaking into houses and murdering young girls.
How and when did they get a sample of your DNA?
Probably 2 to 3 hours, maybe into it, in walks what turns out to be a Louisiana state police. And he was a very large man. It seemed like at the time he was 7 feet tall and 400 pounds. He had a mouth swab, 2 latex gloves, and he was walking directly towards me right from the door. And he's like, we're going to take your DNA now. And I backed up and I went, whoa, wait a minute. You know, what is this? This is crazy. Should I get a lawyer? And he said, well, do you see this warrant? And that means that you have to give your DNA to us right now.
What the officer said was true. Like with any search warrant, a judge can sign an order giving police the right to collect your DNA if police can explain to that judge why you're a suspect. Idaho police had zeroed in on Michael after trying something they'd never done before, putting crime scene DNA, collected from Angie's murder, through a genealogical database. Michael says his dad gave a DNA sample to that database more than a decade ago. The nonprofit organization that owned the database had visited the Mormon church Michael's dad went to, asking people to take part.
The Mormon faith puts a lot of stock into genealogy because of religious purposes.
Mormons believe in identifying dead ancestors who were not members of the church and baptizing them so the whole family can be together in the afterlife. Years after Michael's father gave his sample, that genealogical database was sold to Ancestry.com. Idaho police searched it using a DNA analysis that's less exact than what's used today. They found a close match. Then they got a warrant to make Ancestry give them the name. It was Michael's dad. They researched the family and honed in on Michael because of his movie and his friends in Idaho.
Basically, my father participated in a DNA sample collection, and, you know, 15 years later, I am being pulled in as a suspect in a murder.
What struck me about the Esri case was that this was using a non-law enforcement database, and that struck me as quite noteworthy.
Natalie Ram teaches law at the University of Maryland, and she learned about Michael's story in 2015. This was the first known time police had searched a genealogy database instead of the usual criminal databases created for police. Those law enforcement databases may have problems, Natalie says, but at least they have supervision. State labs have to follow specific procedures. Database searches might be limited to certain crimes. And the criminal database, CODIS, holds only DNA profiles of people who've been arrested or convicted. So by law, they've already lost some privacy rights.
By contrast, the consumer genetic databases are comprised primarily of people who have decided they're interested in learning more about their DNA, what it can tell them about their ancestral origins, what it might tell them about their future genetic medical risks, etc.
Pretty personal stuff. So personal, says Natalie, that consumer DNA databases need oversight, laws about when and how police can use them. In her view, it goes back to the basics of the Constitution.
We have a balance of values between privacy and crime solving, between liberty and crime solving. After all, law enforcement could solve lots more crimes if they were able to enter anyone's home at any time just because they wanted to. We don't allow that.
When privacy activists first heard Michael Usry's story in 2015, the criticism was quick and severe, tough enough that Ancestry.com cut off public access to the database where police had found his father. Natalie says that was the right move. But people working in genetic genealogy say that's wrong. Consumer DNA databases should be easily available to police. I decide to visit Parabon, the company that's built a business off genetic genealogy.
Oh, it's nice in here. It's so hot already.
Welcome to D.C., right?
Right.
CEO Steve Armantrout shows me around headquarters. It's just desks and computers in a bland office building in the D.C. suburbs. They outsource all their lab work. My eye catches some small iridescent pieces of plastic on display.
Wait, what are these?
So those are microarray scanner chips.
What's actually on them?
So DNA gets washed over these chips. They have probes.
DNA sticks to the probes, and a computer analyzes it.
So it's like the piece of the DNA that you're reading?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So whose DNA is that?
I don't know. These are expensive chips that our partner lab gave us.
Somebody's DNA turned into art for display. When we sit down in his office to talk, Steve argues that police using genetic genealogy to find a suspect is just like looking for clues on Facebook. What if a cop, he says, finds a photo of a suspect with his arm around a victim? And he didn't post it. His aunt did.
He didn't give his aunt permission to do that, but she's made an association. Those associations are all around us. DNA is another one. And police use all of those associations all the time when they're doing an investigation. That's sort of the heart of what they do. So I don't see that this is a lot different than photographs on Facebook.
The right to privacy can depend on what choices you make, on Facebook or with your DNA. Steve points out that when you send in a spit sample or you share your DNA profile on a commercial website to look for relatives, you're agreeing to the terms of service.
As long as people are voluntarily allowing their DNA to be searched, I just don't see where the privacy concerns arise.
I asked Natalie about that argument. She says that voluntarily sharing your DNA profile is different. It's true, she says, the person sending in their own sample may be fine with police sifting through their genetic connections.
But it's fundamentally untrue with respect to their genetic relatives who may have never used one of these consumer genetic services, would never want to, and are being implicitly made findable through this database through no voluntary conduct of their own.
People like Michael Usry. After police swabbed his cheek in the interrogation room, they took him home.
They dropped me back on my sidewalk, and that was it. I didn't hear anything from them, and on the 33rd day, they sent me an email that said, "Hey, Mr. Usry, your DNA did not match the sample from the crime scene, something you already knew. Sorry for the inconvenience. Your DNA will not be used for any other testing purposes. Thank you. Have a nice day."
But he knows his DNA was kept and looked at again.
And I know that because a year and a half ago, the Idaho Falls Police Department sent my sample to this company called Parabon Labs.
Idaho police were still looking for Angie's killer. Last summer, they turned to Parabon and genetic genealogy. Cece Moore, Parabon's chief genetic genealogist, used the genealogy website GEDmatch to find the man whose DNA was at the murder scene. That man confessed. He's now in prison. Michael Usry is not. But the experience has made him wish he could keep his DNA private.
This information could be used for a lot of different purposes. Wouldn't it be terrible if our DNA information was used to persecute and prosecute people that didn't agree with them politically? We all think that things like that couldn't happen, and yet we will see.
It's impossible to know where DNA technology will take us. Hollywood has some ideas.
They are going to find me.
But in a place where any cell from any part of your body can betray you, how do you hide? Welcome to Gattaca.
But in real life, here are some signs of where we already are. This month, the Trump administration launched a pilot program mandating the collection of DNA samples from detained migrants. Those samples will be entered into CODIS, vastly expanding the FBI's database and using it to enforce immigration law. They say this complies with a 2005 law. Until now, border police had an exemption. And last September, North Dakota prosecutors filed felony conspiracy charges against a man who protested the Dakota Access Pipeline 3 years ago. They found his DNA on a cigarette butt at the scene, and they tracked him down because of a past arrest. And then there's China, where the government is rounding up a Muslim minority called the Uyghurs.
Senator, that's a remarkable number. 1 million Chinese Muslims in camps.
Right.
Because the Chinese government cracks down on them because of their religion. Why, A, is that true? And B, why don't we hear more about it?
It's absolutely true. They're collecting the DNA of these individuals, by the way, as well, forcefully, and using potentially American technology to do it.
Concerns about police use of DNA have even been raised in the Supreme Court. In 2013, the court considered whether it was okay for police to take DNA samples from people who are arrested but not convicted. The now late Justice Antonin Scalia argued against that.
This will solve some extra crimes, to be sure. But so would taking your DNA whenever you fly on an airplane. Surely the TSA must know the identity of the flying public. For that matter, so would taking your children's DNA when they start public school.
Scalia lost the argument. The court ruled that police can collect DNA if you're arrested. Michael Usry was never arrested. He was only a suspect in the murder of Angie Dodge. But he was so freaked out by his experience with the police, he decided to learn as much as he could about genetic genealogy and about the Idaho killing. Along the way, he got drawn into details about Angie, her death, and her life. She was the youngest of four children, a year out of high school when she was killed. An online tribute her family posted remembers how, as a teenager, Angie would drive with one hand on the wheel and one foot out the window. Michael's now friends with Angie's mom, Carol.
Carol always referred to Angie as her angel, her little angel.
The man who killed Angie, Brian Dripps, lived across the street from her in a small bungalow with a wide front porch. And police questioned him, along with other neighbors, after the murder, but they couldn't connect him to the crime until they tried genetic genealogy 2 decades later. This makes Michael feel torn.
Do I want murderers and rapists to be caught and prosecuted? Yes, of course I do.
But he's also told Angie's mom about his fears.
And I said, Carol, you know, I have to say I'm kind of opposed to this technology. It just scares me to think about the world that we are going towards with this.
In both Michael Usry's case and in the murders of Tanya Van Collenborg and Jay Cook, police normally only get access to these DNA databases if private companies are willing to share them with law enforcement. So what happens when those private companies change their minds? That's next on Reveal from the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX. From the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX, this is Reveal. I'm Al Ledson. Today, we're looking at genetic genealogy, a new crime-fighting tool that police are using to solve cases that had gone cold for decades. The first was the Golden State Killer. Since that arrest nearly 2 years ago, police have used this technique to find suspects in dozens of violent crimes around the country, and the list is growing. Some of those suspects are already dead, a handful pled guilty and are in prison. But in the case of Tanya Van Collenborg and Jay Cook that we heard about at the beginning of the show, the accused killer pled not guilty, and William Talbot became the first criminal suspect identified by genetic genealogy to face trial. Reveal's Emily Harris watched it unfold in a courtroom in Everett, Washington over the summer. And just a heads up, this story has some graphic details.
William Talbot's murder trial opens on a mild June morning, a Friday. Friends and family of the victims and reporters fill the public viewing area of the no-frills courtroom.
All rise for the jury.
Jurors take seats in two rows along one wall. From there, they can easily see the judge, the prosecutor, and the alleged murderer. Talbot has been in custody for more than a year. He hardly moves as prosecutor Justin Harleman lays out the case against him, centered on his DNA.
The evidence in this case will show you that there is only one reasonably possible perpetrator, and that person is William Talbot II.
Talbot's defense lawyers never contest that his DNA matched the semen samples recovered from clothing in Jay's van and Tanya's body. But public defender Rachel Ford tells the jurors that that doesn't prove anything, except that he and Tanya had sex.
They never stopped to consider that perhaps the person who left the DNA was not the murderer. If we were talking about DNA obtained from a murder weapon, or even DNA obtained from the blanket that was wrapped around Jay's body, there might be a better, stronger inference that that DNA was related to the killer.
The defense never offers jurors a full alternate story. They don't have to. Prosecutors have to prove their case. But as I listen in court, I wonder, okay, what really happened? So later, in an interview in Rachel's office, I ask.
I mean, who knows? 30 years ago, if someone lived a lifestyle where they frequently had one-night stands with people that they never met again, how would you ever be able to come up with a story about how you met someone that was completely insignificant in the trajectory of your life?
Is that what happened? Was that his lifestyle then?
We don't really know. I mean, again, this is all part of the picture that was impossible to recreate. We leave our DNA everywhere, every day.
Thank you all for your service.
The trial lasts 3 weeks. The jury deliberates 3 days.
We, the jury, find the defendant, William Earl Talbot II, guilty of the crime of first-degree murder as charged in count one.
Talbot slumps down at the verdict and whispers,
"I didn't do it."
Verdict form two.
In the end, this jury appeared to accept a positive identification of the DNA as a positive identification of the killer. Tanya and Jay's family and friends were thrilled with the verdict. It seemed to seal genetic genealogy's power at uncovering criminals. Talbot's defense team never tried to discredit it in court. I wanted to know where Cece Moore, who worked on this case and many others, thinks genetic genealogy is heading now. A few weeks after the trial, my reporting partner Kate McMahon catches up with Cece at a law enforcement conference in Portland, Oregon.
Good afternoon, everyone. How are you?
I'm in a brown and gold ballroom at a Red Lion hotel. Cece is standing in front of the room with a PowerPoint deck projected on a screen behind her.
Well, it's always wonderful to be here in the Pacific Northwest.
The room is filled with cops and forensic scientists and, noteworthy, a murder mystery writer, all seated classroom style, wanting to learn trade secrets from Cece.
This is a turning point for crime solving in America, and I think we've seen that over the last 15 months very clearly.
I came to this conference thinking I would find a crowd of detectives eager to join the ranks of Cece Moore. But that wasn't all I found. There's also uncertainty. It turns out that along with all its wins, genetic genealogy has hit some shaky ground. It started with a case of aggravated assault in Centerville, Utah, in November of 2018.
A crime.
It boggles the mind.
That even police can't comprehend.
Why would somebody attack an innocent 71-year-old female in a church playing the organ?
Police were anxious to find the attacker, so they reached out to the owners of GEDmatch. Remember, GEDmatch is the genealogy website where people can compare DNA profiles from different companies. But GEDmatch's terms of service said police could only search the database in cases of rape and murder. Utah police asked for an exception. GEDmatch agreed. But the database owners didn't tell their customers they had changed the rules. That created a backlash within the genetic genealogy community. So GEDmatch changed their policy again. This time, swinging the pendulum in the opposite direction. It completely cut off access to police unless customers specifically opted in. Overnight, law enforcement lost access to all 1 million or so genetic profiles on GEDmatch. Since then, people have started opting back in. Cece explains the current status to her class.
So we only have about 100,000 profiles to compare against now, which is a huge blow, obviously. But it doesn't mean that cases are unworkable. It's just a lot harder.
After Cece's talk, I want to know what police think about all this.
And are you also in law enforcement?
Yes.
Would you mind...
Chuck Anderson is a detective in Oregon. He tells me police need to be careful about how they use genetic genealogy so they don't lose it.
I think once we start using some maybe legal but not necessarily savory techniques to get information in there, I think that's when we're going to start having problems.
What comes to mind as an example?
I'm not really a fan of the submitting the anonymous profiles for that individual site.
So that would be like crime scene DNA is put up onto Ancestry, but it's not disclosed that it's law enforcement that posted it there.
Yes.
I see. That can be done.
I have no idea. But I guarantee you, if it's possible, somebody is trying to do it.
In fact, something like this has been done. In the very first case using genetic genealogy to catch a killer, the alleged Golden State Killer, investigators created an alias to not reveal themselves as law enforcement. Then they uploaded crime scene DNA into a genealogy site and found a relative.
It's, you know, a mistake or two away from an overzealous agency before they decide that they're not open to law enforcement anyway.
One person who'd like to see genetic genealogy taken away from police is a Maryland legislator named Charles Sidnor.
We need to pump our brakes and look at what's going on.
Charles believes it's wrong for innocent people to be scrutinized by police for no other reason than sharing DNA found at a crime scene.
There's no suspicion that law enforcement should have about us, yet we are now caught in this DNA dragnet. It's almost as if we have turned the whole concept of innocent until proven guilty on its head.
In fact, he's so against it, he wouldn't even want to let it help his own family.
My cousin, he was shot and killed in Baltimore. And to this day, I don't think that case has been resolved.
And you wouldn't want to find out by going through GEDmatch and letting the police comb through other people's DNA?
No. No. There's too much constitutional collateral damage.
Charles is mistrustful of CODIS, the National Criminal DNA Database, because it holds a disproportionate number of minorities' DNA. And he points to police overreach as why they should not have access to the much more powerful consumer DNA databases.
When they're looking into my DNA, they're looking at my parents. They're looking at my children.
In January last year, he tried to get a bill through the Maryland legislature to ban police searches in these databases, but the bill failed. Then in September, the federal government stepped in. The Justice Department announced an interim policy on genetic genealogy that's expected to be finalized this year. It says, for example, that genetic genealogy can't be a shortcut for cops. They need to try other investigative tools first. And it says DNA samples must have a clear connection to the crime. It can't be just any DNA found at the crime scene. Parabon calls this new policy well-reasoned and well-researched, nothing that would slow or stop business. Even Professor Natalie Ram, who advised Charles Sidnor, likes parts of it.
If forensic genetic genealogy is here and here to stay, then this policy is a very first good cut at what a policy should look like.
But she's against a new power this gives to local prosecutors. They can use genetic genealogy to investigate any attempted violent crime, not just rape or murder. And she doesn't like that private companies still get to define what crimes police can use this for. One company, Family Tree DNA, is marketing itself as the DNA service people should use to help catch killers.
There is more DNA available at crime scenes than any other evidence. If you are one of the millions of people who have taken a DNA test, your help can provide the missing link. You don't have to buy it.
And just last month, a new website, DNASolves.com, was launched with a similar mission. Within days, even bigger news. GEDmatch, which has over a million profiles, was bought out by a for-profit company called Verigen. The new CEO wants it to serve as a molecular eyewitness to help solve violent crimes. I called Natalie Ram to get her take on this new forensic genealogy marketplace.
Well, I think we are closer than ever to stumbling backwards into a national DNA database. And what I mean by that is not that there will be something owned by the U.S. government that will have a DNA profile for every single American or person who is residing within U.S. borders on file. What I mean is that anyone in the United States will be identifiable through the DNA of some genetic relative.
Back in Everett, Washington, Detective Jim Scharf is still excited about the promise of genetic genealogy. He solved the murders of Tanya Van Kylenberg and Jay Cook and was planning to retire. But this powerful new way of catching criminals is keeping him on the force.
When I was a little boy, all I wanted to do was help people and put bad guys in jail. Why would I retire when I've got this opportunity? I'm not finished.
As for the man Detective Scharf arrested for a double murder, William Talbot, he's appealing his conviction. Our show today was co-produced by Kate McMahon, a journalist based in Portland, and Reveal's Emily Harris. Taki Telenidis edited this week's show. Thanks to Seattle public radio station KUOW for their help with trial tape. Our production manager is Mwende Inahosa. Original score and sound design by the dynamic duo, Jay Breezy, Mr. Jim Briggs, and Fernando, my man, Yo Aruda. They had help this week from Najib Amini and Amy Mustafa. Our CEO is Krista Scharfenberg. Matt Thompson is our editor-in-chief. Our executive producer is Kevin Sullivan. Our theme music is by Camarado, Lightning. Support for Reveal is provided by the Reeve and David Logan Foundation, the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, the Jonathan Logan Family Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the Heising Simons Foundation, the Democracy Fund, and the Ethics and Excellence in Journalism Foundation. Reveal is a co-production of the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX. I'm Al Letson, and remember, there is always more to the story.